Welcome to Show Me the Way, a podcast presented by Spencer Fain, LLP. I'm your host, Dave Sider. I'm entitling in this segment, Welcome to the 180. Matt Slauson. Now, I've known Matt for a while, obviously, again, joining us on the show. He is the owner of Paradise Asphalt and has had a very unique journey. And he has taken the unusual course, I think, of becoming an employee of a company, working to sell the company for the owner to ultimately buying that company. Hello again, listeners. It's Dave Sider. This is the Show Me the Way podcast about business succession planning and the use of merger and acquisitions to achieve that successful exit for you and your company or to grow your company. I'm entitling this segment, Welcome to the 180. And my guest today, Matt Slauson, is going to ask me, what does that mean here in a minute? But it'll become very self-evident. In this episode, I want Matt to share his recent escapade or adventure in acquiring the business he's now running, but he will as well give you a little bit of background about himself and how he got into the business that he is in the paving industry. I'm your host, Dave Sider. Matt Slauson has had a very unique journey, over the last 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, more or less, Matt?
Yeah, 4 or 5 years now.
Matt, let's start with your background. I indicated that you work and are the owner of Paradise Asphalt. But let's start with your background. How did you get even going down to the road that you got into Paradise Asphalt? It must have been long and or arduous.
Maybe a little bit of both. But I think it's been an interesting journey. Background, going to school was civil engineering, and I've always been tied to construction. Even though I shifted my degree to computer science, I've spent 90% of my career in the construction space. I joke with my wife, it just kind of always pulls me back in. So had an interesting journey. I'd be happy to explain a little more on getting to Paradise Asphalt. And then, as you said, I appreciate the title, the 180, going from taking it to market and selling the company to actually ended up buying the company. So yeah, it's certainly been a journey, but it's been a blast along the way. And I've learned a tremendous amount. And it's been fun utilizing what I learned and continuing to learn more from individuals like you, Dave, and others that I work with. There's always more to learn.
So before Paradise, where did you work?
So Dave, good question. Before Paradise, I was actually with a concrete contractor here in town. And it's interesting because at that contractor, working with the owners, when I kind of started thinking about someday owning a business, and he really wanted to groom me to take over that business. Unfortunately, as time went on, maybe I was a lot younger, maybe I was a little impatient, but I didn't see the path to that destination. So ended up leaving that company. At the time, Paradise really wanted someone to come and start a concrete division at the company. Come to find out, I got into the business, and the joke is we still don't have a concrete division to this day. there were a lot of other things that kind of got uncovered, went through a turnaround, things like that, which I'll share more on. But that's kind of what got me to the company, and then from there evolved in my roles and responsibilities.
So when you first joined Paradise, what was your title, formal position, or did you have one?
Yeah, I really didn't have one. I think for about 3 months, I was called the director of systems and processes or some ambiguous made-up title. But I think within, 3 to 4 months, I shifted into what was the GM role. And that GM role gained me a lot of exposure to all the elements of the business.
Excellent. So as I understand it, you've got some, for lack of a better term, a little consulting work outside of the business, given your, experience in construction generally. And obviously, from what you said, it comes from various directions. You're also helping businesses on the side. Can we talk about that a little bit? Because I think it adds some color and context to what you've brought to your business as well. I'm not sure if the consulting helps the business or the business helps the consultant.
I think both statements are true. I think what I've done in business, I'm able to apply in the consulting, able to bring best practices to those clients and help them grow their business, achieve more freedom in their business, or hopefully ultimately exit their business. But that said, one of the inside jokes amongst consultants sometimes is that we actually learn while we're providing value and helping them grow. So to your point, Dave, I think I've been able to take a lot of little things from various clients on the consulting side and continue to improve my own business as well. So yeah, I've kind of ebbed and flowed on the consulting side of things, but since 2016, I've been doing a fair amount of that, dialed it back a little bit with the acquisition, but have seen a shift in that space from not just helping them grow their business, but as you well know, successfully exit their business as well.
So let's talk about it. You jumped on board with Paradise. When did that happen?
Yeah, so I came on at the very end of 15, and I really say 16 is when that GM role was kind of bestowed upon me, and we really went through a big turnaround. Paradise was a great company, great reputation, but really struggled on the processes, and there was no job costing in place. And so there was just a lot of changes that we had to bring to the company to help it be more profitable. And in doing so, you know, I always joke, we cut the top line by almost 40% while skyrocketing the bottom, you know, seeing literally $1 million swing in profitability. So sometimes you got to build a foundation before you build that top line. And that's a lot of what we were doing in 16 into 17. Which then led to tremendous growth, you know, 17 through 19, which kind of leads us, you know, to that transition piece in 19, which I'm sure we'll go into a little deeper.
Let's talk about that a little bit. So in 2019, you know, I don't know if any of the listeners remember, that was before COVID, although the last three years have probably dulled our senses to any kind of a timeline in the 21st century, but you were approached by the owner at that time about selling the company. Did you go to market or did somebody approach you? Or how did that all work?
Yeah, absolutely. Fortunately, in 18, literally a year prior, a partner and I completed a successful deal of a different paving company through the consulting space. So that was really the first or second one I was a part of and honed my skills on kind of what it looks like to get a company ready. And I think that's something I want to circle back to is everybody wants to exit, but you got to get ready for that exit. But that said, really honed the process through the consulting. So then in 19, was able to build the anonymous one pager, build the confidential information memorandum, the SIM as we call it, and take it to market. And it was a unique experience because I'd done it in the consultant role. And now I'm an employee, but quasi consultant, helping him get to that exit. And fortunately, had some good success there and worked through the LOI stages, you know, the letter of intent, and then went into due diligence. And that deal progressed. As you know, these things take some time.
Right.
So it was February of 2020. We had some excellent attorneys. Thank you for that, Dave. Negotiating the final APA. And like a lot of listeners probably know, February 20 is about the time where COVID really hit, and that changed everything in terms of where the deal was at, the buyer, you know, finance. I don't know all the details on the buyer's end, but there were some changes from the lending side. And so that deal got put on hold, somewhat understandably. But as the year went on, and as we now know in hindsight, you know, COVID kind of ramped up. By August, that deal was more or less dead, and the owner was pretty frustrated. And from my end, I wasn't really thinking at that point about buying a business. I had been so hyper-focused on selling the business, I hadn't even really started to explore what it looks like to purchase it. But the owner, you know, through a series of conversations, just shared that he still really wanted out. And as you're aware, that was a very hard time, a hard season to do any deals. I mean, you can probably speak to it better than I can, Dave, the amount of deals that just froze and everything went on hold at that time, right?
So you became an owner. You went to the next step. So I want to kind of back up for a minute this way. Consultant to employee to owner. I don't know a lot of people that have made that kind of a jump in such a short period of time. Less than 4 years?
Yeah, absolutely. Less than 4 years.
So as a consultant, what is your mindset when you look at a business? Because I want to compare and contrast, frankly, the evolution that you had to go through, the 180. Actually, it's more like 270 because you had three different roles. But you, when you come in as a consultant, how do you look at a business?
Yeah, so there's lots of things we're looking for. I'm looking at, you know, the first and foremost that everybody wants to hyper-focus on is the financials, right? So the cleaner the financials, the stronger those numbers are, the more attractive an option it is to take to market. However, we also look at what's the team really look like? Mm. So many of these businesses are an owner that's grown it, ran it, and is central to everything, literally touches every component of the business. And regardless of the financial piece, if that's the team, typically the value is going to be reduced. Because most owners, unless they're a little bit younger, which I think I fall into that category still, tend to move on, right? Like they don't stick around a super long time after the transaction. So we really push clients to build that team to help maximize their value. And then what systems and processes does the company have in place to make things scalable, repeatable? Those are all factors. There's others as well, but I'd say those are the three factors that kind of jump out at me right out of the gate when looking at how we're going to help companies successfully exit.
And then you take your own advice, right? You switch gears. You take your advice as a consultant and you implement it as an employee, right? So how do you hold yourself accountable as you're making these jumps? I mean, that's got to be tough.
So that is probably one of the hardest parts. There is a benefit, though, I will say, from being an employee of a business versus a consultant to the business. Because as a consultant, I know what's shared with me. I know what I uncover through conversation and through due diligence. As an employee, especially in that GM role, there wasn't much about the business I didn't know because I'd been running the day-to-day. And so running the day-to-day let me know what cash flows look like in a seasonal business. It lets me know who on the team is really strong, who's not as strong, things like that. So the one benefit to putting it together is you have a very deep knowledge of all the components as you do that 180. I think the hardest part to that 180 is the transparency. You know, I was very transparent with the owner because there's a switch, and it's kind of a weird switch because before I became the potential purchaser, my interests were solely to maximize his interest in his sale of the company. Now that I'm the purchaser, well, that was very much my focus. I have to look at that in light of how does that set me up as the new owner for future success, for scalability, for cash flow, for all those things. And so there were some good, and you were part of them, Dave, transparent conversations with him. And then I think, and I know you work by the same measure, you know, a deal has to be win-win or lose-lose. Can't be a win-lose situation. And so I just kind of made a decision, if we can't make this a win-win, then it's just not going to happen. And he'd have to ride it out, which at that time, no one knew how long that would be. And that was kind of the alternative as we're always looking at it. So I'd say that's kind of part of how I did the 180. Obviously, it's a little more nuanced than that, but it is very, very interesting. And I haven't talked to too many people that have switched, literally take the hat this way and just, you know, switch it around front to back. So.
Well, three ways. I mean, you know, consultant, employee, and owner. I mean, that's quite a bit. Are you continuing with your venture and looking at other acquisitions, or can you speak to that at all? Or is that something private
that we shouldn't talk about? High level, I'll stay high level with it. But I think I'm always looking at, you know, a lot of companies are trying to grow, and there's different ways to grow. There's that organic growth, and then there's growth through acquisition. I think when it makes sense, people should not, especially in this market, overlook growth through acquisition. So as I think about services that maybe we subcontract at this point in time, I'm looking at, okay, what does it look like to acquire a small company that provides one of those services, bring them in-house, you know, recapture some of that margin, help not just the margin gains, but also the efficiencies and schedule capacities, you know, what we can do as a company. So yeah, I think I'm always looking at what helps Paradise Asphalt grow the best, and that may or may not include acquisition from time to time, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So how many hours did you put in a week as a consultant, do you think? Did you ever measure it?
So, yeah, and I can measure it. Back in 16-17, like I mentioned, we were really, especially 2016, going through a big turnaround. Mm-hmm. And so as a way to help alleviate some cash flow issues, I went to the owner and said, hey, dial me back to halftime. Mm. I'll stay in my role. I'll be in here 2 days a week. I'll give you another half a day to a full day. As you know, it tends to become more than that. And then I was going on the road. I want to say every week, but yeah, I was steadily putting in probably 25 to 30 hours a week consulting on top of running paradise. And a lot of people kind of looked at that funny and kind of wondered how that was sustainable. I think in a lot of ways, you know, when we work with owners and help them get their companies ready, we tell them to build the team. And so working part-time forced me to delegate and to make sure we had a good team in place. And so it worked out really well in the long run by doing it that way. But I did consult at that level pretty much till the transaction was completed at the beginning of 21. And I've still been involved in consulting in various deals, but I've dialed that back probably closer to 15 to maybe 20 hours a week, just because there is a lot that comes with not just running a business, but helping it grow.
You, sir, have a lot of energy to be able to do all of that. You've seen, that's a compliment, I should say it that
way. I appreciate it. It doesn't always feel like I have that much, but I'm trying.
So you've seen other people. Let's talk about other things you've seen with companies in buying and selling their companies. What are some of your thoughts on maybe top two or three pieces of advice that you might give to people based upon what you've seen during your time as a consultant in buying or selling a business? Are there any keynotes that you go, hey, that really resonates? I'd like to pass that along to somebody.
Yeah, absolutely. I've got probably two or three pieces of advice, but one thing I've seen, you know, and I've seen a lot of deals. I've seen deals that involve family kind of internal transactions. I've seen sales and been part of sales that sell to a competitor. And then as we all likely know, there's a lot of private equity sales going on right now.
Right.
So I've been a part of all of those. And I think one of the number one things is that building a company for a successful transaction or exit is far different than building what I call a great lifestyle business.
Hmm.
And by that, when I say a lifestyle business, I know many companies, small companies, medium-sized companies, where the owner has just a great setup, right? He's running all the family's cars, the kids' cell phones, the dinners out, the vacations. It's all going through the business. He's probably a key piece. But when you take that company, which has been so great to the livelihood of that owner, when you look at what we call enterprise value, how much enterprise value is really there? And you kind of build in different ways. So I think you've got to focus on that. You have to stay tuned into the market. And then I think the lesson that stuck with me, even as I kind of look ahead, is sometimes people can hold on a little too long. And there's this thing that I've called it peak value. And by peak value, I mean, you know, and this is a true story. I know a company, a paving company up north, they've been around 20, 25 plus years, and they had the best 3 years of their history. And on top of that, the private equity market was pretty healthy. You know, we saw some pretty high multipliers. And there was a deal that he got involved in, and it was kind of midway through, and ego got in the way. And when ego got in the way, he walked away from the deal. You know, it was a great company, had a ton of money, but he just really was kind of stuck on a few things. And within 3 to 4 years of that time frame, I've actually seen that same business, that same owner, complete a deal. And from the conversations we've had, I'd say he completed it for about 60 to 65% of what that previous deal was valued at. And I think that's stuck with me. That's something I've held on to because I don't want to confuse the listeners. It's very important to hang on and build something great and put the work in. But you also have to take a wider perspective and look at what's the market look like? What's your company look like? Be honest with yourself and the team. Can I grow this to that next level, or do I need to bring in other people, other resources? And I would just say, don't let ego get in the way of that, because as we know, ego can often be the enemy of a really good deal. So I think that's a story that's stuck with me. And then there's a couple of smaller pieces of advice I'd be happy to share.
Please. I love it.
So I think on the transaction itself and those that are interested in considering a transaction, the three keys are start earlier than you think. Because we get a lot of calls where a guy's like, hey, you know, and it could be August, and they want out by the end of the year. Well, if you're just calling me and you haven't thought about it before, you know, you laugh, Dave. You and I both know that deal's not getting done before the end of the year.
Not without a lot of pain, screaming, crying, and consternation. No, you're right.
So I'd say start earlier. Yeah, start earlier than you think. The second piece I would say is when someone comes to us and they want to talk about transitioning their business, the first thing I do is not come up with the valuation of the business. The first thing I do is discuss with the owner and say, what do you need? What are you looking to get out of this? Everybody's at a different place in life. They have different investments, different needs. So I don't care what the business is worth. I need to know, what do you need to make this a successful transition? And if that number, you know, pick a number. If that number's $4 million, okay, we take that number, we set it aside. We, you know, he works with his financial planners. He looks at his other investments. So be it. Then we get to the valuation piece. And if there's a gap there, then let's not waste anybody's time. Let's figure out, how do we bridge that gap? If there's not a gap there, you know, then I say, let's go down the path. But when I say determine your number and stick to it, you have to stick to that $4 million number. And I don't want to confuse anyone and say, like, don't fight for a higher number. Don't let, you know, great attorneys like yourself negotiate tooth and nail on your behalf. However, if you're into the APA and now all of a sudden you think you want $6 million instead of four, again, and I know I mentioned ego, I don't want to come back to ego, but greed plays into that as well. And greed can get in the way of very, very good win-win type deals. And unfortunately, I've seen that happen a couple of times. So I would just say, determine your number and stick to it. Start earlier than you think. And my third piece of advice would just be, find a guide or trusted advisor, whether it's a great attorney like yourself or a consultant, or you've got some really good CPAs, whatever it looks like. And no matter how successful a business owner you are, there are just things you don't know. There are things I didn't know about the process. There's things I still don't know, in all candor, and I continue to learn. But a great advisor or a good attorney can really bridge that gap. And for me personally, I feel like this is one of the top, buying a business or selling a business, it's probably a top three, maybe top five decision you'll make in your life. You know, shy of who you pick to marry and having kids and even buying a house, I would say it's a bigger decision. So make the investment. There's no excuse for not being prepared. So do the homework, find the right advisor, let them help walk you through it. And it'll be one of the best returns on investments you make, because you're talking about some pretty big numbers on deals like this. So I think start earlier than you think, determine your number and stick to it, and then find a guide or trusted advisor. And I think if you do those three things, it'll be a much, much better process.
You know, I'm sorry to step on your words. I wish I would have talked to you before I written my book, because you hit on three areas as well. And your advice would have been really good to be part of the book, because one of my chapters is what I call the immortal man, a guy that's going to live forever. And, you know, it's to your point about maybe not so much ego with this guy, but, you know, they just can't really see the business without themselves, or, you know, at the end of the day that, you know, they'll always be around. And that, I think, makes it more difficult to figure out how to separate from the business unless they get their deal. And it leads to the second point, their deal. I will ask people, what's your business worth? And invariably, what they're really saying is what I need out of the business, not what it's worth. And so I usually ask folks to do a waterfall up front, which for me is defined as, okay, you want X, what's the net that you're going to get out of it? You know, and is that going to be good enough? I went through that in the last 30 days with someone and determined it's not enough. So we got to go back and, you know, refocus the company. And another chapter in the book that I have is the Oregon Trail chapter. And that is that selling a business is not dissimilar, I think, in many ways, thanks to a friend of mine, Tom Nolte, who came up with the idea, than to travel the Oregon Trail. Meaning, if we're here in about 1848 in Independence, Missouri, or in the central part of the country, and you're trying to go to the Oregon coast, you know, and you meet a wagon master, and he says, I can get you there. But you go, no, I don't think I need you. I think I can figure it out. Okay, well, you obviously know where to ford the river, where you go to feed the oxen, and where there's available water, and, you know, make sure that you don't run into anyone that could cause you some discomfort, like a Native American, because you're trespassing on his land. And, oh, don't even worry about the, you know, the mountains and the cold, and, you know, there won't be any food. I mean, you know, I'd like to think people could do it on their own. Some can. They're rare, but boy, it's sure a lot more difficult. You know, really great insight, or at least
I love that analogy of the Oregon Trail. Sorry, it illustrates it so well. On, you know, you think you're saving a few bucks by not paying that wagon master, but what's your life worth? What's your family's life worth? You know, all the belongings you're trying to take with you. I think it's a great analogy that illustrates it well. And you touched on a point, Dave, that I think often gets overlooked. And I appreciate your perspective on it because you're very upfront and forward with your clients on the psychological component of doing a transaction or a deal like this, because you mentioned, what does it look like after, especially for those maybe getting to the twilight years or, you know, that are phasing onto that next chapter of life. Their identity is wrapped up in that business. And a lot of them are so focused on the financial side, they haven't thought about what about my identity? What about my day-to-day? What does my life look like? And so I think those are all things that should not be overlooked.
Well, to your point, I learned something. All credit to Dan Sullivan, the strategic coach. He taught me something called the retirement trick. And what you're supposed to do is write down everything you want to do in retirement. And once you get it all down, you know, focus on specific measurable items, time, places, people, events, then literally strike the word retirement off the top and go, that's what you have to do now. Because I think until you can see what's next and embrace what's next, I'm not sure you leave your business, or at least I've seen a lot of people say, I'm not sure what to do. And, you know, frankly, then they delay in selling. And I know at least one guy is just not going to sell. I mean, I think he's just going to, you know, die at his chair. And I don't say that to be cruel, but it's okay. If there's nothing else, you know, it's okay. There's still ways to deal, you know, with the business at the end of the day. Speak to, if you would, a concept called deal fatigue, would you? And that is to say, in every deal, you get to kind of a breaking point, right?
Absolutely.
And where you're going, like, I don't know, up, down, left, right. I don't know what I'm doing, where I'm going. Speak to your experience in watching people, and how did you deal with that for yourself and for other people? Because I've never seen it not happen in any transaction.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I really thought, because of my prior experience consulting, that, you know, I'm familiar with deal fatigue. I'd even named it much like you, and I can avoid it, right? Like, it's not going to happen. It's an internal deal. I have a good relationship with the previous owner. But inevitably, to your point, even me, like, I had some deal fatigue. There were times where it's just such a long process. And I think everybody's role in that process is different. But, you know, as a side note, sometimes in this process, you're not telling anybody at your company, right? Mm-hmm. CFO, the controller, your COO, they may not know until later in the process, which is fine. And there's a lot of strategic reasons for that. However, that means you're the person doing all the work around the deal. And quite frankly, even with the best of teams, you have to facilitate communication. You have to provide information. And I had just come from, I don't want to say grueling, that overstates it, but a very tedious process of trying to sell it, right? So it's not like the buying process was a fresh process. I'd spent the last 6 to 8, 9 months selling and then to ramp up. And fortunately, ours was able to get done a bit quicker than that. But yeah, deal fatigue is very real. I find it tends to happen, and I can't say this all the time, but most of the time it happens in the later stages, typically quality of earnings or once due diligence is done and you really get into the APA. And fortunately or unfortunately, Dave, that's typically when you and others are coming into play, right? It's right. The legal side. And there's a lot to it. I mean, these purchase agreements are long and lengthy, and they have lots of exhibits and schedules. And it can be a bit overwhelming for folks like us that aren't used to some of that legal language. And it does. It will cause some fatigue, and it'll start to question, you know, do I want to do this? Is this the right amount? Is this the right time? Should I put it on hold? And I think, unfortunately, I've seen deal fatigue be used against the seller sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And it depends on your place in life. I mean, everybody's different. But one individual I worked with and was advising on was in the 11th hour. And he was experiencing some really bad deal fatigue. And he had some family health issues as well, which never helps. And the buyer just kind of started beating him up on a few things negotiation-wise at the end. And we really encouraged our seller to sit tight and, you know, let the attorneys do the work and it'll be fine. But it's hard because there's also this thing that I call being tipped over.
Hmm.
And what happens in this process, my partner and I who consults with me, we talk about, oh, he's tipped over. They're so far into it. They've talked about the numbers. They don't have any money from the actual sale. But in their heads, on paper, it's there.
It's like, there.
They might as well have it, right? And so So when you have somebody that's built a business, worked in it for 30, 40 years, they're at an age, there's varying issues, they just need to be done. They tip over, and you combine that tipping over with that deal fatigue. And sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes buyers can be opportunistic and take advantage of that.
That's interesting. May I use your phraseology, tipped over? That's good.
And absolutely.
So tipped over means that, you know, he's already there. The game's done.
He's there.
He's there. And so, yeah, that's I've not heard that before. Thank you. Send me a bill on that. Yeah. So break it. You know, I look at acquisitions one way, very linearly on different steps. How would you divide up the process? I mean, as a guy that's been a consultant, helped sell a business, and then become a business owner, you know, in layman's term, and I really mean it that way, what's the easiest way to tell the listeners what the process looks like? Let's not use legal talk, okay? From a business person or entrepreneur standpoint, how would you break it down?
Yeah, so what tends to happen is everybody wants to talk about the deal. And when I spoke at the pavement show last year, I did a session on highlighting this process for both internal sales, because there's lots of family sales taking place, and then a external sale. And everybody wants to talk about, you know, let's do the valuation, let's take it to market, get the LOI. That's a big milestone, right? And then it goes into due diligence. From due diligence, you get to the agreements. And most people view that as the process. But I think there's stuff on the front end of that, and there's stuff on the back end.
Okay.
So on the front end, I would say there's a plan phase, and then sometimes a build phase before you even get to that transaction phase. And that plan phase is really going to look like some of the items we've discussed. You know, what is your number? What's your valuation? It's fine to do a valuation 2 years before you want to sell. There's no issues with that. There's lots of great CVAs out there that they're pretty cost effective, give you a rough idea where your business is at. So let's find those two numbers, determine the gap, make a plan, and then shift to the build phase to get us to the transaction phase, if you will. And then it becomes much more typical, as many people in the M&A space know, it's going to be getting the documents ready to go to market, qualifying the different buyers, having lots of conversations to determine who's the best fit, not just financially and in terms of capital, but there's a culture piece. You know, what's the culture going to look like for my team and my employees? What's the growth plan? You know, is this going to be a good place to work? You see a lot of private equity that want owners to stay in it to some piece, leave a little bit of equity in it for the next turn, if you will. But then I think where it gets lost sometimes after that APA gets signed and the money hits the bank account, you've got to look at the transition. You've got to look at how are we going to communicate this? How are we going to put things in place to make this a smooth transition for both the buyer and the seller? And then keep growing. I mean, everybody tends to think it's over once, you know, we show up to your office and sign the papers, they wire the funds. But now you've got to integrate the company into the new business. And even if you're not staying on, there's probably going to be a transition period as an owner, and you're going to have to be a part of that and help lead the team through that. So there's a lot of communication that needs to take place. And I think that's an area where a lot of the finance guys tied to private equity are starting to learn the importance of the people side and what those meetings and what that communication looks like. Because the deal is definitely that set start and end point, but there's a lot before it and a lot after it.
Let's talk about the point you just raised with private equity. What do you find is the difference, if there is a difference, between somebody who's a third party, a strategic buyer? Let's use that term, somebody that's in the industry versus a private equity or a financial buyer may or may not know anything about the business, but it's not an operator. They just have money. Are there big differences that you see, small differences? Are there any differences?
Yeah, there's definitely differences. I think they can be pretty sizable depending on the group. I think, to your point, private equity is very, very numbers driven, very financial. They haven't tended to be operators. They haven't tended to have the depth of expertise. They've, of course, done their research, but speaking to the construction industry, especially in concrete and asphalt and those things, it's very unique in that, especially here in the Midwest, the seasonality to that business. You know, if people see my financials, the cash flow is pretty crazy because the guys don't work for 3 months out of the year.
Right.
So there's a learning curve there. I think it's been better when private equity has that platform company that's already been set up. So in a lot of industries, I'm sure everybody's seen it, but there's a lot of roll-ups going on, and they're developing these platform companies, and then they're starting to acquire, tuck in some smaller companies. And I think in the right partnership, you have the expertise from the operators at the platform companies that complement the private equity. But yeah, as a whole, I mean, straight private equity versus a strategic buyer, it is night and day difference sometimes on what they're looking for and what they just don't know. So they don't know what to communicate around some of that operational kind of side of the business.
What I also find too, ask you to speak to it a little bit, is a private equity group or a financial buyer almost exclusively is going to hold for a limited period of time. They're not going to hold it forever. A strategic buyer, somebody in the industry, is probably, you know, holding it for a substantial period of time and is not interested as much in turning. But there are exceptions to both rules. But I would say, you know, the majority of the time, if not the vast majority of the time with financial buyers, they're going to turn it in what, 3 to 5 years? What is your experience?
Yeah, in the spaces, you know, that I've been in, tied to construction, to stone and granite, to lumber, to fire and life safety, I'm seeing a 3 to 5 year. Occasionally, if it's more of a family office, you might see them stretch it out to 7 years. But 3 to 5 has really been the standard timeline that I've seen in terms of the private equity hold. And to your point, that is a very different approach post-close of a deal. The way that private equity is going to run that business is going to be pretty aggressive and very numbers driven. Their game is not to create always the best culture or the most employee-driven team. It's to grow that EBITDA number, right? And increase that value. I don't want to say by all means necessary, because that's not always true, but it is a very aggressive approach. Whereas those strategic buyers or more of a long-term hold family office, they tend to take a more sustainable, strategic kind of, I don't want to say softer, but not as aggressive approach than the private equity.
You know, I could keep going with you. We've run over time. Thank you for accommodating me. I'd like to go on for some more, but let me ask you a couple of wrap-up questions. What's next for you professionally and personally?
Yeah, that's a good question I've been chewing on a lot lately, because I am the type that always likes to take on new challenges. Right now, I'm focused on kind of growing this incredible team we have here at Paradise Asphalt, which allows me to look for growth opportunities for the company. And it lets me continue to consult and advise with select clients. Personally, I'm a big believer in always continuing to learn and educate myself. So right now, I've been focused on studying the financial side of M&A transactions and really working on creating better financial models and diving a little deeper into the valuation methodologies. Not with the intent to wear that CPA hat, but to bring a deeper level of understanding and help clients as we guide that team of professionals. So I think that's kind of my focus right now, and we'll see where that takes me. But outside of that, I think I'm really just personally focused on just being present in my personal life as well. And, you know, I've got 2 kids, 8 and 6, and I know these next 10 years are going to go pretty quick. So as aggressive as I am on the professional side, I'm really being intentional about engaging and enjoying, you know, every second of what's ahead.
Fantastic. So I think as I walk away, if there was a call to action here, I think there are 3 lessons learned. You left us with 3. Revisit those quickly for us. What are the 3 things?
Oh, the 3 pieces of advice? Absolutely.
Yes, sir.
I think start earlier than you think on the process.
Right.
It takes longer. Determine your number.
Right.
What you need, and stick to that number. You can go higher, but don't get greedy. And then finally, find a trusted guide or advisor to help you walk through this process. As you said, Dave, don't go trying to get to Oregon all on your own. So find someone to help you out.
I really, really want to thank Mac. I went over the timeline. I could go on. I literally could go on for a couple hours with Matt. I really appreciate
it. I could as well. I enjoy it. I appreciate the conversation, Dave. It's always a pleasure, and be happy to speak to you again. It's always fun.
We will definitely do that. So where can they find out about information about Paradise Asphalt?
Yeah, paradiseasphalt.com. And you can find me, Matt Slauson, on LinkedIn. Happy to engage and answer any questions and help people any way I can.
Thanks, Matt. I want to let our listeners know that if you're in search of assistance with this type of situation that Matt has gone through, or whatever your situation is, please go to davesider.com and schedule a free consultation. I'd ask our listeners, too, to please subscribe to the show, rate it, and leave me a comment on your favorite podcast platform, such as Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And to the listeners, I look forward to our next podcast, and I hope you will travel this Oregon Trail with me. Thanks again, Matt. Until next time. Under Missouri law, I am required to indicate that the podcast is provided for educational purposes and does not constitute legal advice and is not intended to establish an attorney-client relationship. The recommendations contained in this podcast are not necessarily appropriate for every individual or business. In determining the best course of action, please, as a business owner or an individual looking to get into business, consult with an attorney on their or your distinct circumstances.